scene. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
I could not be more excited about today's morning show because we are going to be talking about something that is very important to me and my life, and I know very important to many of you as well. But in some ways, the most important aspect of this interview is for all of you who maybe do not see yourselves as particularly creative. It is the contention of my morning show guest, award-winning journalist Matt Richtel, that all of us are creative beings, even if our professional lives are not devoted to something that we immediately think of as creative. And more so, it's not just that all of us in one way or another are creative, but that it is woven right into the fabric of our being, that even on a cellular level, we were created to be creative. And it is something that is at the heart of the human experience, and certainly very much at the heart of human history as well. And Matt Richtel, who is a science reporter primarily for the New York Times and a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, has written a fascinating book about this called Inspired: Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. And in his book, Matt Richtel seeks to disavow us of some of the really careless assumptions that we make about what it means to be creative, who is creative among us, and the function of creativity in our lives. The book is absolutely fascinating, and in the course of it, he speaks with a number of different creative people, including people that we would immediately recognize as creative forces, and others who are creative or who are creators in kind of less conventional fashion. The book is published by Mariner Books, again titled Inspired: Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul. And Matt Richtel, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hey, Greg, thank you for having me. And thank you for your introduction. It was really nice.
Well, I really, really love the book. And as somebody who is privileged to live a life in which I get to be openly and extensively creative in all of my professional endeavors, it was really great to read this book and understand more about what creativity is all about. At one point in the book, you say, creativity comes from our most essential survival machinery. We are creative machines. I think that's really intriguing because I think there is a very common kind of creative sort who would probably bridle at the notion of utilizing that kind of terminology to characterize creativity. I mean, I think you know what I mean.
Yes.
One kind of a creative soul probably, you know, avoids the technical and the machine related and sees creativity as something entirely apart from that world. And of course, you're using terms like machinery and machines in a little different way. But explain why you think it's important for us to introduce that element, that terminology, into the mix.
Well, I do think some people who fashion themselves creative or who have succeeded tend to lend an idea of mystery to this. And I actually don't think it's quite that mysterious. It's not the province of the genius. In fact, you'll see in this book, among the many studies, one that shows that having a particularly high intellect makes no difference. And Greg and I, as your guides here, will tell you, you can just be of average intellect. No offense, Greg. I'm right
very
there with
true.
You.
Very true.
But I think what stops people isn't innate ability. What stops people is a couple of factors that interfere with one's ability to tap into that random connection of ideas that I spoke of earlier. And this is very real. This is a so if you're out there saying, well, I've wanted to try this creative thing, but I get in my own way. I say no, that's not perfect, that doesn't work. In point of fact, that's much more what stops us from tapping our innate creativity than is some lack of fundamental ability. And in fact, I know many people who are, say, in big fields, in Hollywood, in writing circles, in other places that have tons of tools and block themselves from tapping the breadth of their creativity out of certain kinds of fear. Would it be okay if I got to the science of that really quickly?
Sure.
Well, one of my favorite studies, and I get into it early in the book to explain why we don't tap our creativity, has to do with how we actually view creativity on a subconscious level. Everyone says, oh, not everyone, but most people say, creativity, wonderful, that's great, let's do it. Oh, who doesn't want to hire a creative employee? But a group of scientists have done a series of studies where they look at the subconscious bias against creativity. They run tests using sophisticated computer modeling to look at how people feel when they're sort of reacting without thinking about it. And they draw associations between creativity and toxins and poison and vomit. Now, do you have a theory, Greg, on why that might be?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Okay. Well, it's very powerful that we see creativity as extremely disruptive.
Mm.
And it is disruptive in a lot of respects. Let's just take something as simple as Elon Musk, or not at all as simple, however you want to see it. It's just simple in that it's a big grand idea, who I write a little bit about in the book. Here comes the battery-powered car. You have to think that when Elon Musk was hit with that idea, it was the kind of euphoria we described earlier. And he goes about and starts to transform an industry, among others, but it means changing jobs in Detroit, changing jobs in Germany and other auto-making giant countries. It means changes indirectly to the fossil fuel industry, which means lost jobs. There's no way to see major creations in our world without thinking of them as both incredibly as pushing progress and destroying what was already there. And if you look at that on an individual level, when you see new creations in our lives, they force us to change. And change is hard, and you could even say change is a kind of death. So, on a basic level, we resist creativity because of what it represents. And then there's another key reason we resist creativity, but I don't want to put people to sleep. So should I get into the mind-wandering science or yield to you?
Well, I just want to first step in to read one paragraph in which you talk about this, and I think you say it, I mean, it just underscores what you just said so very well. You write at one point in the chapter From Cradle to Muse, creativity is disruptive. Creativity means changing how we relate to the world, go through our day-to-day lives, what we eat, listen to, watch, how we interact with one another. Creativity changes long-accepted behaviors, technology, and basic social contracts. It can be wrenching. And so, in other words, when we understand that about creativity, then we also understand why we tend to pull away from those creative ideas, big creative ideas that are going to transform all kinds of things. And that is a scary prospect. I suppose some people, maybe relatively rare individuals, might relish that opportunity, but I think most of us are wired to be cautious or wary of doing something like that.
And that's at the societal level. That is experienced on the individual level when it comes to allowing in thoughts that break the patterns we have come to accept as part of our lives. Meaning, if you are taught to think a certain way, these are the rules, this is how things are done, the act of allowing thoughts in and embracing those thoughts that break basic status quo rules in your head is actually hard. One simple way to think about this is that mind wandering is a portal into creativity. So if you were, and I'll give you a very concrete example of this in a second, what I mean by that, because it sounds, I need to break it down. But if you let your mind wander, it will go to places that may become uncomfortable. I'm not supposed to think that. That's an amoral thought. That goes against the rules of the system. Why would I ever think about writing a song or starting an app or creating my own business? I'm going to shut those thoughts out. And the first step in stopping your own creativity is failing to observe, listen to, or honor those thoughts. Now, Greg, I would ask you, how did you get past that?
Well, sometimes it's, I guess sometimes it is out of necessity when there is a really pressing need for something new. That would be an occasion that would allow me to kind of rise above those fears and reservations.
Was it something, do you think you were taught to be accepting of thoughts that may be outside the rules? Or do you think you somehow came to that through trial and error?
I would say a little bit of both. And I think I'm kind of a mix of my mom and dad and some of those tendencies to pull back versus forge ahead. And I suppose a lot of people are kind of a messy combination of those.
One of the interesting bits of research is that a lot of people do not like sitting with thoughts coming in, and in fact, letting a mind wander oftentimes becomes a worrying mind. And so people will do activities to avoid letting their minds wander.
Mm.
I'm not going to get into all the science, but there are a bunch of ways here, because I don't want to be too long, because it might take too long. But in the book, it gets into some steps people can take to tap into those thoughts. And it's where those moments of explosive excitement come, because what happens during that period is you begin to let dots connect, moments of information, emotion, fact collect together, and suddenly people get hit with something, and it can be all across a range of ideas. I'd like to give an example of you mentioned I talked to lots of celebrities in this book, and I do. There's Yo-Yo Ma and Judd Apatow, the comedic guy, and Steve Kerr. And am I allowed to mention Steve Kerr?
Sure.
In Milwaukee?
You are, absolutely.
We'll see you on the other side.
Right.
We'll see you in the finals.
Right.
But I want to tell you about Mike Lee, who you've not heard of, but is an inspiration to Rich's story. I know him because I knew him as the regular guy who is the father of a friend of my son's at school. What I didn't know is that in about 2003, Mike Lee was going to get married, and he had a feeling that a lot of us have when we get married. I'd like to look a little slimmer in my tuxedo. He just had an authentic feeling that didn't feel very good, and he went to 24-Hour Fitness to get fit, and the person there said, "Oh, you got to count your calories," and handed him a piece of paper to count his calories on. And Mike thought, "Wait a second, I know how to do a little bit of programming. This is the 21st century. I'm going to try to do this on my computer so that I don't have to fill out a form every day." And he ripped up the piece of paper, and he went home. And I'll spare you the long story, which is just a thrilling, inspirational story. But he and his brother sold their company, MyFitnessPal, for $500 million to Under Armour. It didn't come from anything other than an idea that he was smacked in the head by, allowed in, and followed down a 10-year path.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Matt Richtel, and we are talking about his amazing book called Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul, in which he examines a lot of the assumptions that we make about what it means to be creative, who can be creative. I mean, he disavows us of all kinds of myths, including at one point when you say we often assume that creativity is for the few, and creativity is part of all of our lives, whether we like it or not or understand it or not. I wanted to ask you about another myth involving creativity and creative people that that you try to disavow us of, and that is this notion that we have of the creative genius being kind of a solitary figure locked away in their studio or locked away up in the attic doing creative things in kind of a splendid isolation. And, of course, what your book examines, and we've already touched on this, is the fact that so much of creativity, especially in its most successful or sort of influential fashion, is done in wonderful collaboration, although we don't often think about creativity in that realm of the collaborative.
I start this book in Jerusalem, and I think the first line in the book is King Herod was the Steve Jobs of his time. That's what my guide told me as I walked around Jerusalem, and I wanted to go there because it is the center of so much phenomenal creativity. It's the ultimate industry town, and the industry's religion, and the books are the most read of all time, by which I mean the Bible. And I thought about that quote. King Herod was actually a pretty vicious person, but did a lot for the building of the innovation around building of cities and architecture. And I started to think, was King Herod a genius? Was Steve Jobs, were they singular geniuses? They obviously were doing something very right. And that's when I stumbled on the research that said the reason Jerusalem was so rich with ideas is because it was actually pretty highly populated. It had 500,000 people, which was big for the time, and they were all talking about ideas around where human beings came from, the nature of our essence, was there a God, what was the nature of that God, and ideas came from collaboration, cooperation, and competition. And if you look over time, even though a genius, quote-unquote, or an artistic or tremendous intellectual force of creativity may appear to be isolated, he or she exists in a really rich stew of people thinking about similar ideas. Florence, Harlem, Russia, France, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, New York with the financial industry. These are people who are cooperating with ideas in the air and competing with ideas in the air. And to that end, Greg, I will make this case. We are in the single most creative period in human history. Why? Because we are so connected with our devices that we are, I refer to the world now as the new Jerusalem.
I like what you say when you talk about Jerusalem as being, it's saying throughout history there have been outposts of explosive innovation, hotspots of creativity, cooperation, and fierce competition, and you list them and explore the legacy that each of them have. When it comes to what limits us in terms of being creative in our own lives, one of the things that you point to is perfectionism, which I believe at one point in the book you call the number one enemy of creativity. And in fact, I think you go on to follow up by saying there isn't even a close second place enemy. I mean, perfectionism is such a dampening force when it comes to our own creative exploration and creative attempts.
One of my favorite stories mm-hmm. involves Einstein. The scholar who studies the greats says Einstein goes to a colleague once and says, "Oh my gosh, I've got the unified field theory, finally." And the colleague says, "Albert, nice, but under that theory, the universe can't exist." And what we know about creators, those we remember and those we don't, is that quantity is what defines them, not quality. Creators tend to come up with tons of ideas, and many fall by the wayside, and even the ones that do often are driven by a sense of excitement. Here's the thing. Creativity, by definition, involves going into an area where there hasn't yet been an answer or if there's something new. How can you possibly know if it will work until you try it? So by definition, if you're determined that that thing be perfect, you can't create it in the first place. You have no idea. This shows up in so many ways where people start to second-guess themselves so early on in a creative process, creating an app, creating a business, creating an artistic experience. Perfectionism is the number one enemy of creativity, and there is no close second.
I'm reminded of at some point in the book where you're kind of talking about what creativity is. I believe you quote Albert Einstein as saying, "Creativity is intelligence having fun." So in other words, creativity and intelligence are not exactly one and the same thing. But of course, they are linked. But the idea of intelligence having fun, I suppose one way to think about that is intelligence throwing off the shackles of feeling like it always has to be right or has to seek the perfect. That creativity is about, in a sense, play and about allowing things to happen, including things that ultimately will fall away. But one thinks about the freedom that is involved in that.
Yeah, and I mean, if you want to feel patriotic, and I happen to, it is a really neat thing about this country, where you've got a lot of pioneering spirit. So that's just one aside. But if you think about just pure intelligence might be able to get the test answers right. But now you're talking about having fun at the same time. I don't think of the SAT as particularly fun. I also think, so that I'm not dismissing the value of the structure side, that when creations work, they often marry an understanding of the structure of the world with a new twist. So it's not that you're just creating something out of whole cloth that has no connection to the world as it is. Quite to the contrary, creativity that has an impact, and I would argue that the very definition of creativity is novel with some impact on the world, good or bad, it has to connect to the structures that already exist. And that is where intellect plays a role. It's just that it's not the only role, and it needs to be combined with fun.
The comments you made earlier about how, in some cases, great achievement partly comes from kind of the quantity of our ideas, that we don't just wait for that one perfect idea to come, but we generate all kinds of ideas, some of which are better than others, and some of which ultimately fall away, and while others kind of carry us forward. I'm reminded of one of the most amazing creative explorations of my own life in something away from the radio station. I'm also the minister of music at a church, and do some composing for my church choir. And one of the members of my choir came to me with an audacious idea and said, "What if you were to set about for this next church year to write a new piece of music for us every single Sunday, week after week after week. And his idea was that something about that, and maybe even something about the framework of that, would allow creative juices to flow in a sense more freely. And I think I don't think he said it at the time, but I think part of it was also a letting go of this need for perfection or achieving the highest pinnacle of excellence at every turn, but just by being comfortable with creating to that extent, that would kind of change it. And I ended up doing that, and I did it for not 1 year, but two, where I created some kind of new piece of music week after week after week.
Well, and that is, I wish I would have interviewed you. That is a great story. And let me ask, what resulted from it in terms of your experience with creativity? How often did you do something that really moved you? I don't know. Just tell us a little bit about that. It's such a wonderful example.
I'm glad you think so. I would say one of the things was that just by creating to that extent, I became kind of more acquainted with my own creative juices and maybe my own creative process. And it also became a bit less intimidating. It allowed me to kind of approach the each and every project, I think, with a little less sense of monumentalism and more of a sense of okay, it's this Sunday, this is the lesson. This is the scripture lesson, and I'm going to take part of it and set this to music, and here we go. And in a sense, it kind of lessened the sense to which each and every undertaking was kind of a big, ferocious challenge. But I became, in a sense, just more comfortable with being creative, and at some point had to let go of that kind of quest for perfectionism. And I look back, the legacy is, I should think, checkered. I don't think anything I wrote was awful, but not everything I wrote was wonderful. But it's like that was okay. There's plenty of music in the world that isn't particularly wonderful. But there was something about just allowing myself to live within that framework that really did change the way I approached it, I think, for the better. And although
I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're hitting at something so, so important, and I almost have never put words to this. I don't think I've put words to it before, but I think another reason we fear getting into creativity is we're going to discover that we're not going to get discovered, that we're just a regular old creator. I sent you that piece of music. For the listeners, I told Greg before we got on, I wrote a song to go with the book. I write a lot of music. It's been humbling and gratifying to realize that writing music is a blast, and no one is ever going to call me Paul McCartney. And so I realize I'm doing that largely for me, and I may create some songs that people like, and you may create some songs that people like, but we're just very human in the end. And what that goes to is that being creative means setting aside some of your ego. You really got to lay yourself bare and say, this has its own value, the experience and the process, and it may or may not come to fame or riches or recognition. I just want to point out one key piece of research, Greg, and I think it's a place probably you and I connect on. The research will show that people who allow themselves to be creative are happier. Maybe that's the punchline of this whole thing. I think in my own journey, where I had a big bunch of creative blocks, it's how I know about, on a visceral, personal level, all the stuff we're describing, and I found a voice inside myself, creators are happier. They feel less burdened. They feel more in touch with the world around them, and more able to share with the world around them.
I like that. I like that very much. And one of the things you talk about in your book is how when we look at people who are exceptionally creative, you write at one point, these creators tend to exhibit extraordinary curiosity, humility, and openness to discussion and ideas and interests that go in many different directions. So, yes, exactly the opposite of that isolated genius up in the attic. You know, this kind of creator lives in the world. It's interesting. I'm reminded of something else. This was wonderful advice I was given many years ago by the American composer and arranger Alice Parker, for many years the composer in residence for the Robert Shaw Chorale, one of the best choral groups in America. And when she came to Carthage College, where I teach, many years ago, and it was my wife who actually had the guts to ask her for advice for an aspiring young composer, meaning me. And Alice Parker's advice was, write for people you know. Write for the local high school choir, or write for your own church choir, or write a solo for someone, for a voice you know and love, because then you're not trying to write some wonderful song that the whole universe will fall in love with, but you're crafting something in connection with somebody else. And that proved to be probably the single best advice I've ever gotten as a composer, of writing, in a sense,
that's
in response
great,
to the talents of others.
Great nugget. That's just a great nugget, because I think when people go to create for the universe, they get out of their own voice and try to mimic something that somebody else has done. And for people listening, again, it's Greg and I are talking from personal experience about artistic matters, but this would apply to you know, creativity cuts across every medium. So it really, you can see this in, I don't know, I say that one of the biggest places I see it is with a lot of entrepreneurs I know. They are such optimistic, fired up people, and they really are into what they're doing, and it's kind of thrilling to watch.
Well, and one of the words that comes up a fair amount in your book is hope, that at the heart of it, creative endeavors are about hope, and the hope that something that we are creating is going to make some kind of positive difference in the world around us. And maybe that's part of why creative people are often happy, even though, of course, the creative process can sometimes be unhappy and frustrating. But at the heart of those who create is this sense of there are possibilities for things to be even better in this world.
I think that, first of all, I write very early on, there's a lot of bad news in the world. This is not part of it. I mean, I didn't want to write a book about hope. I just realized I was right, because I was putting my own sense of optimism first, not a desire to write a book about hope. But this is a good news book to my mind. And I want to get at that tension that you just mentioned about, you know, sometimes people who are creative are seen as struggling or wrestling. Two things can be true. I think there's a moment of inspiration for, let's talk about all the startup people that I know here in Silicon Valley who are so fired up. There's also a time when some of those ideas don't work, and there's a reckoning with that. And just like Charles Schulz, who we started this conversation with, he woke up the next morning, he's like, oh, no, not quite it. Wait, I've got a new idea. It can be true that you can be disappointed by the challenges of that idea not working as you thought it should have. But it doesn't do away with the optimism and hope that came with the idea that spurred it, or the next idea that will follow.
That's kind of what it's all about. By the way, in the chapter of the book called Laws of Nature, you kind of talk at one point about the place of, or the relationship between creativity and, for instance, someone for whom their religious faith is really, really important. And I appreciate the care with which you write this portion of the book. And by no means do you say that one kind of cancels out the other or negates the other, but it is possible for one to have kind of a religious framework that, in a sense, is rigid to the point where you are consciously excluding ideas and influences and possibilities outside of that strict framework.
So this is some research by the guy who did the toxins and poison research, and it's easy to oversimplify what, on its face, what the research showed was that people of profound faith can experience a limitation in their creativity. But it's easy to oversimplify that as saying, oh, if you're religious, you're not going to be as creative. That's a bunch of hogwash. And you can see a trillion examples of why that's not true. The really big takeaway, if you peel back the what that research says, is two things. On the biggest level, if you have a really, really rigid worldview, it is quite hard to let in ideas that run afoul of that worldview. And so that could be any rigid worldview. And let's take an example right now of the extreme partisanship. If you are so partisan on one side or the other that you can acknowledge no value in some of the ideas of the other side, it's very hard to broaden your perspective enough to see that there may be a lot of valid viewpoints in the world. That's a rigid worldview. It's also true, what the scholars say, that it really depends in this instance, with this worldview around religion, how you perceive God or your God. Is your God one that encourages human creativity and inspiration? Or is your God one that says there is only one way to do things? And if you even so much as think about an idea outside the lines, you have violated your covenant with God. That is by definition going to limit how far you can go outside those ideas. Does that make sense?
It does. I think you're saying that very, very well. And it also explains how, you know, some people find one of those contexts to be very, very comfortable, and others would find it terribly stifling. And also it points to the fact that it is not kind of a black and white thing, and that even the sort of freest spirits are living within a context that they're not always fully aware of. In fact, I want to read the very end of this particular chapter in which you say this: all of this discussion about religion underscores a larger point, which is that all creations exist in a certain context. A big takeaway for me is that the ideas that stick around, are the ones that strike a powerful balance between being novel and being relevant. And of course, that is really intriguing as well, because I think we sometimes kind of sloppily or carelessly think about creativity as mostly about things that are brand new. And this circles us back to the point that in so many cases, what might at a glance seem utterly new, utterly fantastic and fresh, is also built upon all kinds of other things that have come before it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can't disconnect yourself from the world you live in. And it's almost impossible to do so. When I go talk to little kids about and ask them to just come up with whatever ideas they want to come up with, and we play a game called What If, and they get to finish the sentence, you know, with all kinds of, what if you flush the toilet and you wound up in outer space? And one of the things I realize as they start following this What If exercise is they ultimately come and tell a full story. They might bring that flush toilet back down to Earth and into our lives, and if what I just said sounds crazy and inscrutable, there's a bit of a chapter on that very story. But the point is that we internalize the structures of the world around us. So it's not often that we come up with ideas that are so insane, so crazy and far-fetched that they don't connect to the world. And in fact, for them to really catch on, they've got to have a lot of the real world in them, but enough new to strike a chord as being exciting or a form of progress.
Mm. Well put. Towards that end, I think it would be interesting to just spend a couple minutes talking about your conversations with Golden State Warriors coach Steve Kerr, who you say at one point is someone who is exceedingly open in a jock culture that can be very closed. What did you learn about creativity from basketball genius Steve Kerr?
Now, again, are we running afoul of the Wisconsin audience? Are there going to be nasty cards and letters to me?
I sure hope not.
if we're closing up and you do want to send me nasty cards and letters, Greg, I'm going to give you my email for anybody who wants to send anything. It's my name, mattrichtel@gmail.com. But I will tell you that Steve is a great, great guy to talk to because you have this impression that he's going to be this distant giant who's shining you on and not really interested in your time or you taking his. But he's so curious about the world. He wants to know what I'm doing. He wants to kick ideas back and forth. And the way this showed up in the form of an NBA championship, and now I can't remember the year, it was the year of their first championship, and I know everyone there knows what these numbers mean. They'd won 69 games. They'd had a crazy year, and yet they were down in the finals 2-1 to LeBron and the Cavs and playing in Cleveland. And Kerr realized he had a problem, and he wasn't quite sure how to solve it because they'd gotten to 69 wins in a sport where 50 is like the mark of greatness or excellence. And he wasn't sure what to do because they'd run up against LeBron. And there was a guy in the video room of the Warriors who happened to see some tape of how Greg Popovich had covered LeBron in prior times. And it involved a long story short, the video guy sends a note to Luke Walton, who's Kerr's assistant coach, in the middle of the night. Luke Walton mentions it to Kerr. Kerr says, wow, that's a good idea. It involved changing the starting lineup that had gotten them 69 wins. And I won't tell the whole of the story, but they go on to win the national championship. And the guy they inserted into this starting lineup, Andre Iguodala, wins the MVP. And what's interesting about that? Well, after the series, they say, Kerr, what a great idea. He's like, well, it wasn't mine. And the thing is, here's a guy who's so open and so humble. And look, he built that team, and he built it with Curry and others, so let's not take any credit away from a guy who's just a master. But he's also open enough to hear ideas that come from somewhere else and put them into a structure he created and win an NBA championship.
Hmm. That's a really nice indication of the wide range of your book. And although you and I spent a fair amount of time talking about creativity as it plays out in the realm of music, that your book is also about entrepreneurs and athletic coaches and great thinkers and bloodthirsty rulers and many, many others who have all engaged in this life-giving exploit of creativity.
Yeah, for anybody, listen, if you want to be a bloodthirsty ruler, this is the only book you'll ever need.
Yeah, there are some really interesting stories. And again, it really expands our notion of what creativity is all about. I want to circle back here at the end to back to fear. And one more story about my own creative exploits, if you don't mind.
Please.
So far,
yours are the best stories.
Several years ago at the school where I teach, where I coordinate the opera workshop program, we had a strange situation for the J-term opera where we had 7 women registered and 11 men. I mean, it's probably the largest group we've ever had. And for the women, I already knew, we have just the right women to do Puccini's Sur Angelica, this beautiful one-act opera with a cast for just women. And I was excited it would complete the trilogy and so on. But what in the world do I do with these 11 men who have registered for Opera Workshop? And it sounds crazy, but the simplest solution was to create a new opera for these 11 men. And with the stage director who had some experience as a librettist, I brought this crazy idea to him. I really was scared to even say it out loud. He was crazy enough to agree with it, and The two of us ultimately created a one-act opera called Black September that was about the experience of the hostage crisis at the 72
wow.
Olympic Games in Munich. But what was so interesting about that is that up until that point, although I'd done a little bit of composing, it would never have dawned on me to try to write a one-act opera. I mean, the very notion was just outlandish, outrageous, and talk about scary. When we had the first day of class that January, I had still not written a single note of music because Matt Barresi, the librettist, had not yet written a single word of the libretto. So it was not till the following Monday that finally we could start giving these 11 guys, bit by bit, this score as it took shape. It ultimately got finished. It was ultimately performed. It was very well received and a powerful experience for these guys. But again, that was a step into the unknown that was necessitated by a need. And that's something else that your book explores, is that sometimes a desperate need for something to be created is all that's necessary for someone to push past their fear and to give it their best shot.
Yeah, I think that is very true. You could see a trillion examples in human history where terror of annihilation, like that bacteria, caused great innovation. Look at the birth of the antibiotic itself, you know, by Fleming. But I want to point out something else: is you still had to be receptive to that, Greg. I mean, I'm really, you know, in our with our prior conversation and before this one, I had not realized that there's probably no better person to be talking about this with you than you, because you are, to the audience in Milwaukee, you guys are sitting on a creative powder keg there with Greg. Like, these are ideal examples, and even though you had a need, there were other ways to solve that problem. You had to be receptive to the idea of going for it.
Hmm. Well, I'll tell you something else. I'll tell you something else. It made all the difference in the world to be, in a sense, part of a community, and in this case, a college and a music department, and with a supportive collaborator and students I knew well and for whom I was crafting this and who were appreciative right from the start and hopeful. And I mean, I think all of that, if I had just been locked in a room, I think fear would have frozen me in place. But that sense of connection with others who I knew would be supportive and encouraging every step of the way, that was essential as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. No, it's a perfect example. I don't think necessity, I've tried to reframe the phrase, necessity is the mother of invention. I think authenticity is the grandparent of invention. And I think without the authenticity first, yours and your ability to receive that information and channel it, then the necessity doesn't get solved that way or solved at all. So I think there's a forebearer to necessity as the mother of invention. It's authenticity. I guess it's what I'm saying in this book that I think everybody has. The secret, I note in this book, the secret ingredient to creativity is you. And I think to the extent we can find that you, like our great grandparents and their great grandparents found it in, you know, getting on planes and boats and crossing oceans, that's what we can do now in various creative spaces.
Hmm. Very well put. Your book was an amazing experience for me to read. I mean, I found that I just learned so much. It helped me understand where I've been, where other creative people I admire, where they are coming from, and this great mystery that is woven into all of us, whether we are even aware of it or not. And I appreciate the wide-ranging nature of your book, and yet its focus and cohesiveness. You've really achieved something special with this book, again titled Inspired, Understanding Creativity, A Journey Through Art, Science, and the Soul, published by Mariner Books and the author Matt Richtel. Matt Richtel, our listeners probably will find it hard to believe, but we've just scratched the surface in this wide-ranging conversation in terms of all that's in your book. I congratulate you on giving the world a really important book, and I'm really glad we could talk about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gray. So gratifying. Really, really appreciate the conversation.